Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. This is New Books in European Studies, and I'm your host, Jill Messino. Today, I'll be speaking with Machteld Wenken about her new book, Peripheries at the Center, Borderland Schooling in Interwar Europe, which was published by Berghahn Books in 2021. Welcome, Machteld.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
Just a little background on Dr. Wenken before we begin. She is a professor of contemporary transnational history at the Luxembourg Center for Contemporary and Digital History. She earned her PhD in 2008 at the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium and her habilitation in 2018 at the University of Vienna. She has been a principal investigator of 8 research projects funded in 4 European countries. Her main research areas are transnational, transregional, and comparative histories of Europe, migration, borderlands, the history of families and children, and citizen science. So, Machteld, can you tell our listeners how you became interested in this topic?
In my first book, I focused on migrants from behind the Iron Curtain who settled in Belgium during the Cold War, and more specifically, I compared the experiences of immigrant men and immigrant women. And afterwards, I was a postdoctoral researcher in Poland, and there I was given the opportunity to write an expertise paper on the history of women and children for the Museum of the Second World War in Gdańsk. And this was the first time I read about children's war and post-war experiences, and I became interested in the situation of children in border regions that switched state sovereignty as a result of the war or after the war. And my first articles on the history of children are also about this period of time, the early years after the Second World War. But then I felt that I needed to understand what had happened before, and this is how I ended up writing a book about children in borderlands in the years between the First and the Second World War. And let me mention one other thing before we move on. This book is the outcome of a large and long research project I conducted in Austria. I moved to Austria for the project. I worked at the University of Vienna, and then after the project, I moved out again. And so it has been a privilege to do this project in Vienna. I was surrounded by a lot of scholars interested in borders, in border changes, and in life in borderlands.
Well, it's really a fascinating and impressive work, and indeed necessary, because certainly we need to know a lot more about some of the institutional changes that occurred in the case of your book, Schooling, in these borderland regions. And I'm particularly looking forward to using it in the classroom because I teach a class on war and its aftermath. And this book will be really useful for illuminating some of the social effects of war and, in particular, territorial change. And I especially appreciate your focus on everyday life as well. So I'd like to start with a general discussion of your book, and you focus on the border changes that occurred both to the east and west of Germany after the First World War as a result of the Treaty of Versailles. So can you tell our listeners about these territorial shifts, including the reestablishment of Poland, and why you chose these particular case studies, namely Polish Upper Silesia and Eupen, Sanwit, and Malmedy in Belgium?
Well, the title of the book is Periphery's at the Center. And I chose this title in order to point out, yes, we are not used to thinking of borderlands as places that can be central to our understanding of a history of Europe. And I developed the thesis in this book that after the First World War, when statesmen gathered in France to lay out the conditions of peace, they were convinced borders on the continent needed to be replaced so as to bring Europe to order. In other words, making peace meant, to a great extent, mapping Europe to peace. And the book demonstrates how the borderlands they mapped became the places where these imaginations of a peaceful Europe experienced a great challenge. And in order to do that research, I developed a symmetrical comparison of two case study borderlands. And these are Polish Upper Silesia in interwar Poland on the one hand, and the regions of Eupen, St. Vith and Malmedy in interwar Belgium on the other. And these pieces of land, they switched to another state sovereignty after the First World War. And before, they used to be part of Germany. Now, comparing Poland with Belgium seems a little bit odd, but it's not. In fact, it's well motivated. I used five selective criteria in order to come up with exactly these case studies. So first, I wanted to assess the way in which the League of Nations influenced the life of borderland inhabitants. And this influence was present in Central and in Southeastern Europe, but not in Western Europe. And this is why I felt the need to include one case study from Central Europe and one from Western Europe. And that is how I ended up selecting my borderlands from the pieces of land that switched sovereignty following the Treaty of Versailles, because that treaty covered territorial changes in both parts of Europe. And the second criterion was then that, Belgium turned out to be an interesting case because it had this constitution guaranteeing the freedom of religion and the practice of languages. And so it actually offered its inhabitants, you could say, an alternative protective system to these protective measures for minorities supervised by the League of Nations. So that is why I chose Belgium as a Western European case study. And then third, I opted for a borderland in interwar Poland and not for one that joined Czechoslovakia or Lithuania, because it's a book about children and compulsory education was implemented in Poland and in Belgium at the same time, right after the First World War. So this made the comparison nice. And then the fourth decision, that was because these regions of Eupen, St. Vith and Malmedy, they were practically entirely Catholic, Roman Catholic regions. And that is why I also wanted to have a predominantly Roman Catholic border region in Poland as well. And this is why I selected Polish Upper Silesia. And then the last criterion is, these regions of Eupen, St. Vith and Malmedy, they are covered with woods and agricultural lands. And because Polish Upper Silesia was much bigger than these regions of Eupen, St. Vith and Malmedy, I downsized the analysis to its most rural district. And this was the Lubliniec district. And it had a relatively comparable size and number of inhabitants.
Well, you definitely make a compelling case for why these regions warrant comparison. I'd like to ask a broader question now related to identity and nation. So how does your study of borderland regions illuminate the complexities and contradictions associated with national self-determination in the post-war period? And perhaps before this, you can tell us how you define borderlands.
This principle of self-determination, it was the president of the USA, Woodrow Wilson, who so vehemently supported this principle when he was in France after the First World War. Now you see that many parties involved at this negotiation tables, they gave it different interpretations because it was a vague concept. And that's why it could not possibly rectify the continent's problems. So was this to give the opportunity to all to live in what they imagined as their own state? Or did the concept refer to elaborated democratic self-government? That remained unclear. And moreover, this intertwinement of self-determination and peace, this did not always mean much in Central and Eastern Europe. Because when the Great War came to an end, you have these competing aspirations of self-determination within lands of former multinational empires, and this competition could take the shape of a civil war, and it then generated facts that these architects of Europe's peace in France could not ignore. And so in the end, the results of using that principle sometimes took the form of consensus decisions that were made about the shape of state border lines. And these were indeed predetermined by the architects of peace in France. And then they were later to be discussed and ratified within individual nation states. And this is what happened in the case of Belgium. But sometimes they were dictated by troops on the ground. And that was, to a great extent, the case of Polish Upper Silesia, in a way. So there were uprisings, and then there was also a plebiscite, and then the outcome of the plebiscite could not possibly, on the basis of the outcome of the plebiscite, you could not possibly split the region between Germany and Poland. So in the end, it was a decision made on the supranational level. The definition of borderlands, so usually it refers to pieces of land finding themselves on opposite sides of one state borderline at the same time. This is the definition mostly used by borderland scholars, especially those not working on historical topics. But given the fact that Germany never abandoned its aspiration to regain the pieces of land it had ceded, so I considered a borderland for this book a piece of land that used to belong to one nation state and then it switched state sovereignty. So I'm interested to see what happened when nation states contested lands at their state border lines. And for this historical study, the temporal dimension is very important, because after a switch of state sovereignty, you still have certain discourses, practices from the past that still influence the situation. And so I approach borders, therefore, as very complex historical contingent processes and borderlands as places where different ideas on belonging are negotiated and renegotiated while making use of or adapting past discourses.
So you already discussed what triggered your interest in childhood, but why schooling and educational policies? Why are these fruitful sites for examining identity, how it was constituted, refashioned, expressed, even contested in these borderland regions?
Thinking in terms of children was a way of thinking in interwar Europe. In fact, in the book, I say that in interwar Europe, there were three ways of thinking that came together. Thinking in terms of borderlands, in terms of language, and in terms of children. Thinking in terms of borderlands, we already discussed that. The Treaty of Versailles thrust imagined ideas of a peaceful Europe onto borderlands. And this is why it makes sense to write a history of Europe from the perspective of borderlands. This is why peripheries were central. Thinking in terms of language. So you had maps that were stretched out on tables in Versailles. But there were also statistical data on knowledge of language, and these were used in order to draw state border lines. You really see that language, it was believed, yeah, that this was the primary foundation of national belonging, one language, one nation. And then thinking in terms of children. So when Poland and Belgium gained state sovereignty over these new border lands, they possessed pieces of land where compulsory education had a long tradition and they had not. And control over education within these newly gained borderlands was considered essential for the functioning of these interwar nation states. And this control, it was believed, would offer the prospect of a common national socialization project for all of the country's youngest and future citizens. And so the argument that I develop in the book is that this thinking in terms of borderlands, of language and children, that taking that together resulted in the elevation of borderland schools as a basic foundation of the interwar European political setup. So these borderland schools were elected to play a crucial role in the creation of a stable Europe. And language learning in borderland schools was used in order to prepare pupils to grow into citizens able to bring about a peaceful Europe.
So there was this idealistic component to schooling in the borderlands. And so that schools could be important for forging national identity, but not an exclusivist type of national identity based on discriminatory practices, and a national identity that could be combined with a supranational identity to help prepare peaceful European citizens, essentially. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the sources you use. So what types of sources do you draw on, and what were some of the challenges you had in accessing sources? You note that a number of sources were destroyed during the Second World War. So how do you account for this in your analysis?
Well, in the end, I conducted research in 15 different archives in Poland, Belgium, and Germany. And most importantly, I lived in the borderlands. I lived in Katowice in Poland, and I lived in Eupen in Belgium. And these regional sources, I really saw that there was an imbalance between the Polish and the Belgian ones, because Polish Upper Silesia had operated as a distinct political entity, and so it had generated paperwork about this border region specifically. And this was not always the case for the regions of Eupen, St. Vith, and Malmedy, so it was more difficult to trace the paper trail. And then, of course, you had documents that were not available. In Eupen, you had a French-speaking school, but it was set on fire during the German invasion in 1940. And in St. Vith and Malmedy, these cities were bombed during Hitler's last offensive. So the material is just gone. But luckily, the city archives of Eupen were very, very rich. And I also had press sources. And then on the national level, so this means archives in Warsaw and archives in Brussels, so to speak, there the results were not always satisfying. Of course, we know that sources on interwar Polish ministries are scarce because Warsaw lay in ruins at the end of the Second World War. But I was also disappointed that these archives of the Belgian Ministry of Education were practically non-consultable at the time, because it was like 100 meters of archival files and there was no index, and the documents were in chronological and not thematic order. And it was simply impossible to filter out documents relevant for my case study borderland. But archival files in Germany on these contacts with borderland inhabitants, they were in much better condition. So I needed some time in order to come to see that, because before I started working on this book, I had never consulted archival documents in Germany. And I somehow naively thought that by visiting the archives in Berlin, I would manage. And this was not true. Germany has a decentralized archival policy. And, well, it meant I could see more of the country. So it was quite some work for me as an outsider at first to locate these archives, to find interesting collections there, and to really find new materials there. It's not something that pops up the first time you visit an archive. In the first hour you see a doc, you consult archival sources, that you find this new document that nobody had looked at before. That's not how it works. But if you do the work consistently over a longer period of time, then there are new findings. And these are well presented in the book, I hope.
It definitely is. And I think it's remarkable that you conducted so much research in so many different places. Also remarkable that you actually chose to live in these places to really get a sense of the place, the physical geography, the realities of what it might have been like to live in these places during the interwar period. I'd like to move on to chapter one now, and I was wondering if you could sketch out the nature of war in these regions and its impact on children and schooling.
The purpose of the first chapter is to situate the policies towards children in Upper Silesia and the regions of Eupen, St. Vith and Malmedy during the First World War within a broader context of war developments. On the whole, you could say that life during the war was easier for children in these borderlands than for most children who were living at the time in other parts of Belgium or in pieces of land that would join Poland when it became independent in 1918. And this was because children could stay where they were relatively safe, and their schools continued to operate. What you see in the regions of Eupen, St. Vith, Malmedy, children witnessed, and we do have testimonies of that, healthy soldiers marching west and then injured or captured soldiers being transported east. In Upper Silesia, the war remained really an event taking place somewhere else until a civil war broke out in Silesia in the direct aftermath of the war. So the war experience for children in Upper Silesia takes place after the end of the First World War. But nevertheless, what you see is that this First World War is an important turning point for how children were approached by adults, both in Belgium and in what would become Poland. And this is important because it will also then have an influence on how interwar life looked like. So in Congress Poland, which during the war was under Central Powers occupation, Congress Poland enjoyed more decision-making power in education, and it became a laboratory for experiments in what future Polish statehood might actually look like. So policies towards children were prioritized as children were to become the backbone of the new Polish state. And within that process of experimentation, you see how the idea of a Polish child, of what it was or what it would have to become, that gradually took shape. And in Belgium, one also experimented with, for example, with civic education for the masses in schools and also with preventive child welfare, which was then organized on a national level. And these two elements also featured interwar Belgium.
So I'm wondering, to what degree were borderland schools different from or similar to schools in other parts of these countries? So do we see differences in pedagogical approaches and in the curricula?
When I was working on this project and I presented it on conferences, the general remark was, Poland and Belgium, they were so different. You had a different political ideology. The economy was different. But actually, I found a lot of similarities in these borderlands. And so the main finding of the book is that going to school in one of the two borderlands was, and it continued to be throughout the entire interwar years, a significantly different experience than going to school elsewhere in Poland or Belgium. And so I discovered that this, what you could call interwar borderland schooling, had four characteristics in common. And I gathered these four characteristics in a profile. So although the system of power and the economy was different in Polish Upper Silesia and in the regions of Eupen, St. Vith and Malmedy, interwar borderland schooling had similarities. The first one was that these schools were more dependent on international and transnational changes. So you see, for example, in Polish Upper Silesia and in these regions of Eupen, St. Vith and Malmedy, is that these changed state sovereignty out of a geopolitical concern for peace and not as a result of local desires for self-determination. Two, the second characteristic. So special educational policies were a frequent phenomenon in borderlands. Now, it's important that this is not the same as saying that educational policies in borderlands were always special or could not be the same as educational policies in other parts of a country at a particular moment of time. So I really think it's important to follow this borderland schooling for a longer period of time, in my case, 20 years, in order to go beyond such a presentation of ad hoc examples and really indicate this frequency of special educational policies over a longer period of time. And the third characteristic is that within borderlands, policy measures were more negotiable. What you could see is that in these borderlands, both state institutions and individuals could foreground the contradictions in the case of my book, Language Learning Rules, and they were often successful in changing them. And then the last characteristic is that borderlands at the time could turn into places of excess. And this could take the form of like very, very elaborated control measures. And when you look at it in the early 1920s, for example, the control measures applicable to these regions of Eupen, St. Vith and Malmedy, you really see how they encapsulated the contradictions of the Belgian kingdom. So because this local government in the early 1920s in the borderlands was a colonial regime. It was the only colonial regime on the European continent at that time. But at the same time, it was also a transitional one. And the aim of it was eventually enabling borderland inhabitants to enjoy all the freedoms of the Belgian constitution. So here you have an example of excess.
So given that there's more flexibility or elasticity with respect to the pedagogical approaches and even the curricula in these borderland regions, how are these states able to cultivate national belonging? And this gets us to the topic and title of Chapter 3, Making the Border. So how, through educational policies, are Poland and Belgium able to make or reinforce the border?
Making the border is an important chapter in the book. It develops the argument that after these state border lines of the European continent had been drawn, it was about establishing and implementing rules on teaching and using languages in these schools in the borderlands. And that this establishing and implementing rules, that were techniques making the border. So language learning in the borderlands became the border. This was how the border was made after state border lines had been drawn. So what happened is that the solely German-speaking school system from before was replaced by two types of schools that, on the basis of newly introduced rules on language learning, separated borderland pupils according to their supposed mother tongue. And I say supposed because primary education was to be offered in the mother tongue of the child, and the guardian of a child was responsible for indicating what that mother tongue was. But this mechanism created tensions whenever the mother tongue of the child was not considered the language or the languages of the nation. And you see that Polish and Belgian authorities pursued different aims. In Poland, the effort was on promoting a wider use of Polish as the primary language of instruction. And it does not come as a surprise then that nationalists in Polish Upper Silesia attempted to decrease the number of German-speaking schools. Whereas in Belgium, this prescribed ideal for elite pupils was to achieve bilingualism. And so this was done through intensive foreign language training starting in the final years of primary education. And so in Eupen, St. Vith and Malmedy, there were also discussions going on in borderlands about schools, but these were about when to start foreign language training. So you see that in both case study borderlands, the border was made through schooling.
So to what degree would you say that the state was successful in these endeavors? Was there any resistance to these policies? So what negotiations occurred on an everyday level among parents, teachers, etc.?
Resistance, I would say interplay. It was an interplay between state institutions on the one hand and then parents, teachers, children and clergymen on the other. And this is how these borderlands, which used to be spots on a map in Versailles, turned into socially lived spaces through this interaction. That is what then came to be created, a social space. And so the book pays much attention to these negotiations of pupils' language learning. So I really follow the continuous multidimensional dynamics of this reconfiguration of primary schooling at and also across local, national, transnational, and supranational levels of decision making. But if you want, I can give you a small example of resistance in Polish Upper Silesia. New textbooks were made for the Polonization campaign for making children learn and speak Polish. But these were really unpopular, and parents were responsible for buying these books, but they didn't want to, or they were unable to, because it was a time of economic hardship and public financial support was limited. And so the distribution of these books was also limited. And in the sources, you have this teacher asking the parents to buy a textbook, and he was only successful after the municipality made the parents pay a fine for not buying the book. And even then, an unemployed father complained and said that the book did not mention God. And so here is a quote. "This is like writing a book without a dot on the I." So here's a small example.
That's not surprising, given how religious these regions were. I'd actually like to return to the topic of interplay, which you discussed in such great detail in your last response. But in this case, I'm thinking of the role of supranational bodies and their relationship with national authorities, even local authorities in the borderland regions. So can you talk a little bit about the relationship between externally mandated policies such as minority rights protections and local policies in the borderlands?
Supranational control was something for Central and Eastern Europe, not for Western Europe. In Central and Eastern Europe, these newly emerged states had to adhere to this supranational supervision of the League of Nations over the way they treated their inhabitants in borderlands. And these inhabitants were categorized as having a minority status. So the language used in the documents is national minorities. And for Polish Upper Silesia, you have two agreements that were important. You had the Minority Treaty, and you had a more elaborated Geneva Convention. And these detailed out, among others, how education in German in this Polish borderland needed to be organized. But in Western Europe, there was not such a control, supranational control, meaning that this Belgian kingdom, it did not have to fear control over how it governed these regions of Eupen, St. Vith, and Malmedy. And this difference made the systematic comparison by times very challenging, because decisions on the same matter were made on very different levels of decision-making. And an example is closing a school in one of the borderlands. And in the book, I give that example, and I there compare negotiations on the supranational level for Poland with negotiations held within the city council of Eupen for the case of Belgium. So, yeah, the relationship between supranational and local could look differently in different border regions, and could also look differently depending on the moment of time we're talking about.
So we see quite a variation between the two regions with respect to how much influence supranational bodies have. But I'm wondering about religion as well. So what happens to private and religious schooling in these regions during the interwar period? And, you know, you made the reference to the father who was pretty disgruntled that religion was no longer a part of his child's curriculum. But what happens to religion? Is it no longer typically a part of the public school curriculum? And also, what happens to religious schools?
Asking about private and religious schooling assumes this juxtaposition, public versus private, religious versus non-religious schooling. And such fault lines are more accurate for education in interwar Poland than they are for education in interwar Belgium. Because the Belgian state, it did not ambition to play a big role in education to start with. In these borderlands of Eupen, St. Vith and Malmedy in the interwar years, there was one type of school, and that was the Catholic school. And it was state-funded, but only loosely state-controlled. So how is that possible? This result was the outcome of one of the biggest topics of political debate in the 19th century in Belgium. And these were called the school wars. These were verbal battles. And this was political verbal battles. And they had distilled a very clear power structure, with the church having the freedom to develop its activities within Catholic schools, and these schools remained more numerous than state schools in Belgium. And this could lead to very interesting findings. For example, the Belgian state subsidized the teaching of Protestant courses if at least 15 pupils signed up. But this Belgian Federation of Protestant Churches was only entitled to provide that education in secular schools. And now what you see in Eupen at some point in the interwar years, you have parents responsible for 16 pupils applying to the city council to open a Protestant school. And then their request was declined because one could not find a suitable room. And this is because the region only had Catholic schools. And so the right of these children to receive Protestant teaching could not be realized. So you see here how space had turned into an essential factor in the battle over control. This would not have been possible in Polish Upper Silesia, because there, these minority treaties guaranteed that religious right. But in Eupen, there was no supranational equivalent to this Geneva Convention that could intervene or rectify this situation. One comment about private education. In Polish Upper Silesia, private education was there in order to guarantee children could keep on being instructed in German. But this was not an issue in the regions of Eupen, St. Vith and Malmedy. What you see there is that after the war, a language survey was issued. And on the basis of the outcome of that language survey, two language zones were installed. And so there was a smaller French-speaking zone for schools centered around the city of Malmedy, and then a larger German-speaking zone centered around the cities of Eupen and St. Vith. So you see there that local rulers did not have the intention to reduce the number of German-speaking schools. And so also private schooling was not considered necessary.
This is really just so fascinating how the supranational intersects with the national and the local, and the fact that your analysis of these two regions, these borderland regions, yield such a complex, rich portrait of these different groups, different national groups during the interwar period. And on a related note, I was wondering how teachers were recruited. So given that these areas experienced major territorial shifts, in the case of Poland, you have the reestablishment of the nation state. And then, of course, the multilingualistic component of all this, right? In some cases, you have pupils who are learning in a language that is not their native language. So how are the respective regions finding, recruiting teachers to teach in such a challenging environment?
In Polish Upper Silesia, teachers holding German certificates from before the war, they could stay. And I offered the example in the book of two local teachers with the same language competencies, and one decided to work in a Polish-speaking school and the other one in a German-speaking school because they needed to adhere to the demands laid down in these minority treaties, and they needed to operate within school branches offering education in different languages. You also had additional teachers, and these were recruited from elsewhere in Poland or Germany, and later local talent was also trained in Polish state teaching institutions. And this was a dead-end street for German-speaking teachers, because the idea was that Polish teachers would replace these minority teachers. And you see that by the end of the interwar period, not a single institution of higher learning in Poland was still offering training for German teachers. So policymakers, they really aimed to people the borderlands with teachers loyal to the new regime, and loyal meant at the time speaking Polish. And they received, they achieved their goal because in the 1940s, teachers were among the most loyal Polish citizens in Upper Silesia. Now, initially, the situation in the regions of Eupen, Sankt Vith, and Malmedy was different because local teachers, they could become civil servants and stay, but they were required to swear an oath of loyalty to the Belgian state, and they refused massively, and almost the entire staff left for Germany. And as then new teachers were recruited, so mostly from neighboring provinces in Wallonia, and also priests could start to teach classes. And of course, there was also a German language teacher training course in Belgium. But you see that German pedagogues in Germany, they really criticized this substandard pedagogical level of that training. And there you see a similarity, because that also happened for Poland. So German pedagogues also criticized that the level of teaching in Poland was not good. And so you see that this concern that that teachers in the border regions, that they were not given the skills to guide and shape the behavior of their pupils, that that was only expressed by these German pedagogues, because policymakers in Poland and Belgium had a less extensive history with compulsory education and with reform pedagogy, and how the children were to learn their languages, that was really of little concern to them.
That's really interesting, and actually gets me to my next question about the transnationals. So you discuss how foreign policy, particularly the foreign policy of Germany in the 1930s, influences or sought to influence educational policies in these borderland regions. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, a state border with Germany, that is what Polish Upper Silesia and the regions of Eupen, Sankt Vith, and Malmedy had in common. And Germans on the other side of this state borderline, they did not cease to show their interest in the people they considered to have been left behind. And so this interest manifested itself in sending school books, money, spreading pedagogical ideas, welcoming school children from across the state borderline, and. And this means that for me, for my study, that this comparative approach, that it also turned into a transnational approach. And it meant that I needed to follow the changes in German policy priorities over the years. For example, you see that this German support sent over the state borderline, it really intensified in the late 1930s. And an example here can be this ambitious project of German authorities to build the best school buildings in Polish Upper Silesia. And I will quote how they motivated to invest German tax money into the building of schools in Poland. They said, and this is a quote, "This is a preparation for a future recovery of the territory." That's how they perceived it. Now, you see a similar mechanism in Eupen, Sankt Vith, and Malmedy, although there was no need for school buildings. It had a similar logic. The idea was to outdo local initiatives. And in Eupen, Sankt Vith, and Malmedy, this could be done by sending over fairy tale books with lots of beautiful colored pictures. And these could outdo locally produced alphabet books. And local teachers indeed offered these books as prizes to their pupils during German language courses. And this was the most beautiful book a borderland child could possibly get. So it was a lot of money sent over the state border.
I find these two examples particularly fascinating because they really underscore the different ways in which nationalism was promoted, right? State building and nationalism was promoted by Nazi Germany through these soft power initiatives. And you see this more boldly, obviously, in the case of Polish Upper Silesia, whereas in the regions you examine in Belgium, these fairy tale books are offered up as a type of candy for German children there. I'd like to move on to chapter 4 now, where you explore how the border was, quote, scaped, unquote. So what do you mean by this term, scaping? What was involved in this process?
Borderscape. This word unifies the words border and with the suffix scape. And this suffix refers to this multidimensional dynamics of shaping and carving the border, in the case of my book, through education. And it is a concept used in border studies, but I haven't seen it in historiography. Now, for me, this concept really worked because it allowed me to focus on the local level of the everyday life in the borderlands, but also to take into consideration when and how bordering processes exceeded the borderlands. And then you come to see that both borderlands functioned as the physical places where debates were held, or control measures were installed that generated an impact far beyond their geographical area. You see that institutions, teachers, and parents in both borderlands steered discussions towards the contradictions within policies in order to not only test the limits of a certain system of power, but also to bend these limits. So you see that in the borderlands, discussions were held over language learning that were crucial for much wider social spaces within Poland, Germany, Belgium, and the League of Nations. And that is the borderscape. And I even go so far in the book as far as to say that debates over power in these two borderlands took a similar dynamic. And here I use the insights of a Swiss social geographer. His name is Georges Raffestin. And according to him, these diverse and changing interactions between institutions and human beings about education, they yielded to achieve, and here is a quote, the greatest possible autonomy comparable with the resources of the system, unquote. So basically what he says is that these continuous negotiations, that is what you can expect in borderlands. So even while having a different system of power, these borderlands, changes to these systems of power had a similar dynamic.
So basically the scaping you refer to is a type of gardening, a type of constant gardening, I guess you could say, that includes multiple actors and is a process that is ongoing, that's continuous. And so you see these institutions, and in the case of your study, obviously, education and schooling being refashioned, reshaped, depending on local, national, supranational needs. And actually, this gets me to my next question, which has to do with the role of nationalism, and in particular, the increased embrace of nationalism by countries such as Germany in the 1930s, and how that influences educational policies in these borderlands, particularly places where you have ethnic minorities. So could you talk a little bit about that?
In the 1930s, in the regions of Eupen, St. Vith, and Malmedy, there was more democracy than in the 1920s, and in Polish Upper Silesia, it was the opposite. In Belgium, you had the new educational law, and it gave more freedom to local schools in deciding in which language to teach and when to start foreign language learning. Whereas in Poland, you had this minority treaty and the Geneva Convention phasing out. And afterwards, at the end of the 1930s, it was the Polish state that decided in which language a child should learn. And in the book, you find an example of entrance exams for primary school children in German conducted by Polish state officials. So this was about whether a child knew German well enough in order to be sent to a German-speaking school in Polish Upper Silesia. And you see that these 6 years old children weren't given a fair chance. And then also, what is even more important, according to me, at the end of the 1930s, is that these borderlands became increasingly caught up in these geopolitical strategies for a future redivision of the European continent. And both borderlands were basically treated as potential currency that could be used in negotiations with Germany to pay off the security of the Polish or Belgian mainland. So nationalism, yes, but on the other hand, also the idea that, I mean, if it's needed, we could get rid of these borderlands.
And there goes the idealism of the immediate post-war period, in which these borderland regions could be laboratories for promoting peace and multi-ethnic cooperation. Okay, I'd like to move on to chapter 5 now, where you pose the question, did language learning enable borderland pupils to become more equal to pupils receiving their education elsewhere in Poland or Belgium? So what were your findings? How did you answer this question?
Chapter 5 is titled A Universal Childhood. And universal childhood means that all children should enjoy an equitable childhood experience irrespective of their social background. But these concrete ideas on how to realize how a universal childhood should actually look like in practice that were developed in the 1930s in Poland and Belgium, these were very, very different ways of doing it. So you see that universal childhood was really understood in national terms. And in Polish Upper Silesia, like elsewhere in Poland, authorities really chose to control the organization of primary education. And so what you see is a repeat of these battles over the closure of schools not offering teaching in Polish. But on the other hand, what you also see is that the idea of a Silesian child was constructed. And this Silesian child was conceived as being hindered from playing a constructive role in the new Polish nation state. And as a result, this Polish Upper Silesia really turned into a highly innovative laboratory of reform pedagogical experiments and studies. And this supported this idea that a universal childhood of Polish childhood is possible. Whereas in Belgium, this Belgian statesman really understood universal childhood as let a child learn in the language its guardian chooses. And this was made very, very easy. And it prevented a repetition of this earlier language learning conflicts. But the role of the Roman Catholic Church in education was much bigger in Belgium, and it opposed reform pedagogy. And so it was not interested in this, in how a borderland child should learn its languages. Not at all.
I find this particularly fascinating because in the Polish context, as you note, there's this emphasis that the language and primary school language schooling be in Polish, which makes sense given the reestablishment of the Polish nation state. But yet it coexists with innovative, more modern pedagogical approaches. Whereas in the case of Belgium, there's not as much of a concern with language, right? So it can be the language of choice by the guardian, by the parent. Whereas because of the influence of the Catholic Church, you have less innovation with regard to pedagogy. So really interesting how these comparisons play out. Okay, I'd like to move on to the conclusion now. And in your conclusion, you compare your findings to borderland schooling in Soviet Ukraine and Yugoslavia during the interwar period. So could you elaborate on that?
In the conclusion, I started to paint an overview of state policies to borderland schools throughout Europe, but it did not enable me to develop an understanding of this multidimensional dynamics involved in making and escaping borders. And that is why I then decided to zoom in again on two cases and rely on secondary literature to compare with the aim to see whether this profile I developed of similar characteristics in interwar borderland schools, whether the profile holds. And on the basis of the literature study I did, it does. So it seems the profile seems applicable to other borderlands. However, and this is what I learned from the Yugoslav case, it is important to follow where the change of state border lines generated its effects. So think away from the geographical space of the borderlands if necessary. Following the borderscape really means tracing how, after the drawing of a state border line, transient space was given meaning to through the interaction between the rulers and the ruled throughout the country and at various levels of decision making. So it is possible that you can see effects in minority schools in more centrally located parts of a country. So this means that borderlands could vary in spatial extent, and that the meaning of what was peripheral and what was central, that could also change. And so this also means for this profile that the relevance of it and the relative importance that could differ from case to case, and it can also change within one case over time. But what remains true for all the cases discussed in the book and in the conclusion is that the spaces and the lives of borderland children in the interwar years were influenced by borders.
Well, Machteld, we've run out of time. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you, and thank you for sharing your book with our listeners. And before I let you go, could you tell us about your current research project?
As I said at the beginning of this interview, I moved out of Austria. I moved to Luxembourg because I became a professor at the Center of Contemporary and Digital History here in Luxembourg, and I'm holding the chair of contemporary transnational history here. And since a year, I'm also a senior researcher in a project financed by the European Research Council called Social Politics in European Borderlands, a Comparative and Transnational Study. And this project aims to reframe the history of welfare and social care in Europe, by focusing on different border regions, and I am co-responsible for this Luxembourgish/French/Belgian/German borderlands. And there in this project, we look at this interplay between state policies, but also voluntary associations and families co-shaping welfare systems. And this summer, for example, I've been looking at archival documents on transnational veteran welfare after the First World War. So I primarily at this stage looked at what happened with Luxembourgish soldiers who fought in the French Foreign Legion in the First World War. So I look at how a veteran policy was made in the post-war in Luxembourg, a country that did not have an army.
Yeah, it's a really impressive and ambitious project. And I know many of us scholars of Europe, modern Europe in particular, are looking forward to learning more about the studies that result from this project and integrating it into our teaching. And I wish you the best of luck as you continue to work on this project. And I'd like to thank you again for taking the time to speak with me today.
I like presenting my book to New Book Review listeners, and I hope that some of them will find their golden open access copy of the book on the website of the publisher, Berghahn Books. And many thanks to Jill Messino for being such a nice interlocutor.